Hello, everyone. I'm Jamie Smith. Welcome to Connor Contemporary Art. Thank you for coming to the Emerge panel discussion. I have many people to thank for making this event possible, beginning with my partner, Lee Connor, and our assistant directors, Martha Joseph and Patrick McDonough. I also want to thank our sponsors, our media sponsor, the Pink Line Project, and the generous support of Philippa Hughes in promoting this event, and Marvin Restaurant for catering and bringing us the DJ Keenan Orr, who we will enjoy later. And sitting with me here is Marvin's manager, Sheldon Scott, who's also a performing artist and has been kind enough to participate on our panel today. So thank you, Sheldon. I'd like to thank all of our panelists, who I'll now introduce in alphabetical order. Christina Belonik, who's a visual artist, and she is also the program director for Washington Project for the Arts. Christina, thank you. If you just wave and identify yourselves. Thank you. And Zoe Charlton, who is a visual artist too, and she's an art professor at American University. Thank you, Zoe. And Damian Elias, who is a psychologist, Damian, who's currently working at a hospital in the Bronx, and he's about to start a postdoc at Drew University in New Jersey. Also, I'd like to thank Corinne Miller, who's the program manager for Cultural Development Corporation, and many of you know Corinne through Flashpoint Gallery, which she runs. And finally, I'd like to thank Paul So, who's the founder of the Hamiltonian Gallery and the So Hamiltonian Artist Fellowship Program. So thank you all of the panelists for being here today. Now, I'm supposed to announce that this is being recorded for a podcast, so none of us says anything that we really regret later. But I'm sure no one here would do that. At the end of the session, we'll have a question and answer portion, and we'll get microphones out to all of you in the audience who have questions or concise comments for us. So we'll be looking forward to getting that input from all of you. So I'd just like to preface the discussion by making a couple of remarks about this event, how it came to be, and the topic of how emerging artists form communities. There are really two reasons that I wanted to set forth this particular topic now. One is my experience with the annual Academy exhibition that we do here at the gallery. Over the past 10 years, I've worked with nearly 200 emerging artists who are at a very critical juncture in their lives and their careers, where they're just about to leave their art schools and launch their professional careers. And that's a very exciting time, but it can also be a time that's filled with uncertainty in many ways. And artists can feel, I think, sometimes at that moment, a little bit disenfranchised because they've been in sort of the nest of their art programs, and then all of a sudden they don't have that affiliation anymore, and they don't have that built-in support system from their faculty and classmates. So one of the goals of Academy has been to bring all of these artists from their different schools together and let them interact and let them see each other's work. So I think that's one nice benefit. And another goal is to give exposure to the work of these emerging artists to the art community here in D.C. and art communities elsewhere, too. So just that idea of branching out into the community or bringing artists together for the first time in many cases to form new associations among themselves. These themes I'd like to reinforce about the Academy exhibition. And the second motivation for selecting the topic of artists forming communities comes from a recent experience I had being an external examiner on a doctoral dissertation committee at Howard University for a PhD candidate, Damian Elias, who's here with us today on the panel, and he's now, I'm glad to say, Dr. Damian Elias, whose research focuses on artist health and job satisfaction. And Damian's findings, I think, have important implications for the art community. So I asked him to come here today to share some of his findings and analysis with you. So Damian, if you would just get us started by telling us about your research and explain something about your findings that indicates artists' need for community.
Well, my background, just really quickly, I worked at a number of different art schools, most recently Tyler Art School or Temple University in Philadelphia. And I worked in the counseling center, and since I had an interest in art, I had a fine arts minor because I wasn't gutsy enough to actually be a painter. Since I've worked in psychology and I have an interest in art, the career centers that I've worked at, kind of, they filtered the art students over to me. And there was this overarching stereotype of the artist as pathological or sick. Or I get a call from the front desk, we have a Tyler student for you, and they would just pass them over to me like there was going to be some crazy person that I had to work with just because they were an artist. And my friends who were in the arts and the students that I did work with, I didn't think matched that sort of stereotype of the artist as sort of struggling with severe mental illness. So I went to look at the literature, and a lot of the popular literature, along with the academic literature, sort of looked at famous people who were artists, but famous people who were artists that were also, who lived crazy lives and had sort of mental illness and the Jackson Pollocks of the world. But to take sort of Jackson Pollock's life and put that on every Tyler student really didn't make sense to me. So through my academic career, I looked at, I did two studies, both of which are published, on sort of the art student that's not a genius, or not famous, not necessarily not a genius, but not famous. So someone that hasn't really put their name out there so much. It's the normal art student, or the normal person working and also painting on the sides and that. So I looked at my most recent study that Jamie referred to, approximately 200 artists from all over the United States. I know people in L.A. and some galleries, a lot of people in Philadelphia and New York, some in D.C. and more in Baltimore, unfortunately. And I wanted to look at how satisfied people were with their jobs, their lives as artists, and how healthy they were. And I went into it thinking that they were going to be more healthy than sort of the books that I had read about famous artists being unhealthy or bipolar or whatever it may be. Of the people that I looked at, half of them were working in an art-related job, which is actually an important finding that I'll get to. The other half were working in other jobs, but they still considered themselves to be artists or painters at their core. And that was an important thing. Overall, and this is what I kind of mentioned in the teaser video that we did before this event, that unfortunately the sample that I had of the 200 people, they tended to be a little bit more skewed on the negative mental health side than the normal population. And this, I have some brief statistics here. So for example, 35% of the sample said that they were taking antidepressants, whereas the national average is about 14%. 70% of the people indicated through different measures that they had struggled with a depressed mood within the last couple weeks before I interviewed them or they had filled out the survey, and that's 50% more than the average American. 27% took anti-anxiety medication, and that's compared to, again, 14% of the general population. 53% of artists said that they had been smokers, which is way high because the Lung Association says that 21% of Americans have been smokers at some point. And a theme that sort of developed throughout the research, just talking to people, interviewing people, having people fill out surveys, was this general sense of being lonely as an artist. It's a lonely kind of profession or job or vocation, and I mean that overarchingly more than just the job. People tend to do a lot of this art by themselves, whether thinking about it by themselves, painting by themselves. Once they're out of school and sort of in the community, trying to get represented but on their own is very difficult for people. And that can play into sort of a depressed mood and a sadness that people are reporting. But people who did belong to group. So let's say artist collectives are represented in a gallery or showing work, or even people that have an online representation where they can connect with other artists, overall indicated that they were happier and more satisfied with their lives, and also happier and more satisfied with their jobs. And the interesting thing is happier and more satisfied with their jobs, even if they weren't working within the arts. So I've always sort of tried to explain to art students, and more importantly, art student parents, that it's not a hobby. People aren't doing this because it's a hobby. But a lot of professors and parents will say, well, you can paint on the side, but you need to get a real job. And I think that if people can combine those two things, they'll be much more satisfied. Overall, the sample that we looked at indicated that people who worked in an art-related job, so if let's say they're a painter, and that's who they consider themselves to be at the core, a painter, but they worked within the creative field on some level, they indicated they were more satisfied with their lives overall, and they had less mental health and physical health problems as well. So overall, I think the findings that I looked at for people, again, who weren't famous artists, but just the general sort of recently graduated from art school student, or people that have been working in the field for a while, or out of school and then actively painting, one thing that mitigates the negative health effects of just general life and this sort of depressive loneliness is to actually be a part of something greater than just you as an individual artist. So people who do connect with others end up being healthier, both mentally and physically. They indicate less drugs and alcohol use, which is important. And also, another important finding is people who are working in a non-art-specific job and are not painting are less satisfied and therefore less healthy. So if people who are painting but not connected to it at all during their day-to-day job maybe should reach out and try to work in this field or connect with some sort of group above and beyond their accounting job or their physics job, let's say. That could be also very helpful that I found. So overall, feeling that people have a sense of being connected to the world in general, aside from just the art world, is important for everybody's mental health because we're sort of pack animals. You know, we're not really just individuals living by themselves. And if that's the case, that's a problem. And you guys can talk to me later if that's a problem. But being connected to the art world, I think, is very extremely important both for mental health, physical health, and the numbers sort of show that. So that was my research. It kind of set the stage for today's discussion. So, and if anyone has any questions about the statistics afterwards, you can talk to me. I'm happy to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Damien. I think this is very valuable to bring to everyone's attention. Your findings, and I think that we should all be aware of challenges that artists face and how artists' job situations can affect their health and well-being as well. As we probably all know, jobs in the arts are pretty scarce and can also be low-paying. So it's not the easiest thing to sustain yourself with an art-related job. So I'd like for Sheldon to talk to us next about how artists and visual artists and performing artists in the restaurant industry form their own communities and how that industry can be very supportive for those sorts of networks.
It can be sort of a cliche sometimes that people in the service industry are what people like to describe sometimes as more arts-oriented. And a part of that is definitely true. And the reason why that rings true, at least from my understanding, is there's a lot that the service industry does that supports the arts implicitly and explicitly. When I left my professional job as a psychotherapist to begin my artistic career, I obviously did what most people did. I picked up a job waiting tables at a restaurant. One, because it offered me a lot of freedom. These types of jobs in the industry do offer for a lot of flexibility. There's a lot of sacrifice, obviously. You don't have that steady paycheck. You do not have the health insurance. But it's a trade-off for the amount of freedom and flexibility you have in doing projects, per se. There's also a way that your income is generated that's particularly unique. The more you work, the more money you make. That doesn't necessarily work in some other professional settings. If I needed to make more money for a particular project, all I had to do was beg and barter for a few more shifts that week and trade off with some other servers or bartenders or what have you and make that extra money. And then if I needed to take the time off, I could definitely, again, beg and barter to have that time off or that freedom. Another way that the industry kind of explicitly supports the artistic community is obviously when these spaces are built. There's a lot more to it than just the brick and mortar that you see. There's sort of an environment that we are almost obligated to create as a space where people come to socialize. You know, a lot of people go out to dinner for more than just eating. It's not necessarily like a gastronomic experience exclusively. People like the ambiance, people like the music, people like what they see, all those other stimulus, and all those things are very much rooted in the arts, like not visual, but performance arts and music, obviously. When I speak particularly about Marvin and what it has done, I mean, first of all, the place was conceptualized and owned by an artist himself, Eric Hilton, from Thievery Corporation, and it is named in homage of one of the greatest artists of all time, Marvin Gaye. So it was complicit on us to make sure that we built that into the very fabric of that place. And we did that with visual arts, obviously. You know, some of the paintings and the murals that you see on the inside and outside of these buildings, those things weren't accidental. Everything from the Marvin mural on the wall in the dining room to the Shepherd Fairey mural outside, those things were actually quite designed and quite purposeful to create that kind of space. Another way is probably what we're experiencing right now. When Jamie and Lee approached me a few months ago about the opportunity of co-sponsoring an event like this, that is another way that the industry kind of supports the arts. We certainly don't have a problem with providing, you know, food and beverage to the artistic community as much as possible. And, you know, I think that's just basically very technical ways that the way can that they can support. And if you look at a lot of neighborhoods and how the neighborhoods move and grow, you will find that the correlation between what's happening in the creative art scene and what's happening in certain restaurants and bars and different types of venues, they correlate to quite a degree. I mean, you look at some of the neighborhoods where you see some of the hottest and most popular bars, you know, there's a lot of art. There's an undertone of art that lives and breathes in those spaces and in those neighborhoods here on H Street and in U Street, and you've seen it historically in DuPont Circle and Georgetown. You can watch physically where the galleries go, where the restaurants go, and where the artists go. And, you know, I think that's probably one of the most prolific ways that you can lay it out. And I will just kind of stop there and let the conversation continue.
Well, I think that Sheldon has given a lot of good examples of how a culture, an artistic culture, can be a very positive social force, shaping not only the art community but the DC community in general. And anyone who's ever been to Marvin Restaurant knows that culture, feels it as soon, recognizes it as soon as you walk in the door. And I think it's wonderful that Sheldon and the restaurant contribute to art-related events, but also raise money for local charities. So that's another way that artists can interface with the community. But there are other ways outside of the employment structure that artists can establish community networks. And next, I'd like to ask Christina talk about some of her experience as an artist and also with the programming at WPA. And you could probably also speak to that interaction that Sheldon had set forth about the relationship between the visual arts and the performing arts.
Well, I graduated about 10 years ago and moved back to D.C., which is where I'm from. And I was just lucky to come across some arts jobs. And I feel like I worked in an art gallery. I was making very little. But I knew right away that I wanted to meet other artists. And this was like a really fast and fun way to do it. So basically, throughout the years, I've been able to find art jobs. I've also, in another important factor, was I was able to volunteer in art studios of practicing artists and taking on kind of like a mentorship relationship with some of them, learning different trades by volunteering. So, I mean, I guess one of the most important things is to be proactive and also be outgoing and try to meet other artists. But in my day job, which is as program director for the Washington Project for the Arts, I mean, that's an organization that's been around for about 35 years that supports local artists and encourages local art. That is a quick and easy way to kind of join the artistic community. I joined as a member in the year 2004, and I just remember kind of a click over. They have a lot of events and workshops specifically for visual artists, and I met some artist friends there, started meeting up with them and having group critiques, and so, yeah, I mean, I just feel like it's kind of just been an organic string of things, string of events.
Maybe you could share with us something about your studio experience. I mean, you have studio mates. Do you not share a studio?
Yeah, and actually that's another key point I wanted to make is the importance of setting up, establishing a place to do your work. And one resource for me has always been Craigslist. I've been able to find my three studios that I've had here in the city through Craigslist. My first one was a solo studio, which was underneath a furniture store on 14th Street. And that was a little bit more insulated. And I know a lot of artists in D.C. have said they feel insulated. So, I mean, one of those reasons could be if your studio is kind of like, you know, tucked away in someone's basement or... But then my second studio, I was lucky to become part of the Goldleaf Studios, which is a multidisciplinary studio building in Chinatown. And it's home to rehearsal space for bands, photographers, graphic designers, clothing designers. So I'm in a big shared space with three other artists. Nick Pimentel, who's kind of a crossover. He's in the restaurant industry and DJ and artist. Renaissance man, and a jewelry artist, and a painter, and I felt like once I got into that space, things kind of bloomed because I was making connections with other artists that were doing different things and having people to bounce ideas off of, and we would put events together in the space, have bands play, and
And it goes beyond just a social interaction, but you can actually talk about each other's work, which you mentioned critique, you know, and this sort of these sorts of exercises. Mm-hmm. For example, I think Transformer had a, I forget what their program is called, Exercises for Emerging Artists that you participated in.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I think they're in their seventh iteration right now, mm-hmm. this exercises program. And a lot of nonprofit art spaces have... some kind of program that engages, well, both nonprofit and commercial, like you guys, that engages emerging artists in the community. So the exercises program at Transformer selects three or four artists every year and pairs them with a curator. And then it's like you meet up every 2 weeks and you kind of put together, you build a show together. Mm-hmm. And all of the artists create new works for the show based on a theme that has usually come up as a group. And so that was a very valuable experience because, you know, we had mentors come in, like Frank Day. I was in a group with, like, photo-based imagery artists. I do silk screening, but I was with photographers. And we had Jason Zimmerman, professors from the Corcoran. I mean, it was just a really, Andrea Polan from the curator's office. It was just nice to hear their reactions to your work. So definitely to not do work in a bubble is a good idea. Just have... see what people's reactions are.
And can be very stimulating. Yeah, to get feedback. Now Zoe often works in solitude, but she gave some excellent advice to one of my classes last year when she said, "Ask other artists for studio visits if there's
an established artist that you admire. You know, that's what you've done, isn't it, Tilly, when you started out your career? If you would just give us an idea of how you went about it and what that's done for you.
You know, it's really interesting because getting out of school, I wasn't really sure how to connect with the larger art community. I went to school at UT Austin, and I was really confused. I don't know about you guys, but it's something that they don't talk about in school. Do they talk to you guys about that in school? I don't know. I keep hearing a little bit about professional development classes. You guys are lucky if you have them. But something that happened is I was thoroughly confused, and I went to the director of the UT Austin Museum, and I said, and her name is Annette Carlozzi, and I said, okay, Annette, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. What do I do? And she sat down with me. She actually took me to lunch, and she got me a big margarita. It was great, and I was happy. And she says, okay, so what are your goals? She asked me what my goals were, how important community was to me, or if it was, and where did I want to show? How did I see my work moving? And with that list, I started to really sort of ferret out the things that weren't important and the things that were. So the first thing that I started doing, which was kind of naive, and I had Vicky Meek, who had a space in Houston. Actually, when I saw her like a couple years later, she says, oh, yeah, I remember that letter. It was so naive. But I started a letter-writing campaign. And I started writing artists that I was actually interested in. I started contacting them. And I started contacting directors of spaces, of nonprofits, and started writing galleries. And, you know, just like unsolicited. It's not always a great thing to do. You never get, you know, you don't always get a response. But hey, you know, it's like you're young, you're naive, you're an emerging artist. You know, just do it. And it was really interesting because artists started to respond. And they would come to the studios. And so what I started doing in turn was I started visiting their studios. And it's become a really important part of the way that I navigate through D.C. and in Baltimore and in Philly, is I actually see some work that I like, and I contact them, and I go into their spaces, or I go to galleries, especially the DIY spaces in Philly and in Baltimore, and I find artists that I'm particularly interested in, and I ask the directors, who is this person? How can I get in touch with them? I was recently in Colorado, in Denver, and was visiting Plus Gallery and found three artists that I decided that I was completely obsessed with, and I had to meet them, you know? And it was pretty exciting. And in that way, you build connections, and I was able to build connections, build a community, a network of people that I could talk with about my work. I could talk with about the other issues related surrounding my work. And I could also find connections as a way to sort of move into different places so I could exhibit in these other places because those artists had connections with other spaces. And so it was a really good opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So that's a great way to form relationships and also get leads professionally. So I think that's excellent advice. One such place in D.C. that artists might speak about is the Flashpoint Gallery. And I'm going to ask Corinne to tell us a little bit about CUDC's programming for emerging artists and also to describe how the art scene can grow into or interface with the business community and the residential community here in D.C.
Sure. So the Flashpoint Gallery is run by Cultural Development Corporation, which is a nonprofit arts organization that makes space for art. And we have Flashpoint, which houses an art gallery, a theater, a dance studio, resident organizations. And then there's also artist housing in that space. And then we also own and operate the Source Theater, which is up on 14th Street, and run a three-week performing arts festival, which actually Christina participated in this year. And I think is in some ways a really great program that's emblematic of a lot of what we do. So she participated in something called the Artistic Blind Dates, and we're matching up artists from different artistic disciplines. So we'll put a screen printer, a choreographer, and
acting,
a drama professor together for several months, and they produce a piece that's then presented. And I think that's something that's really interesting and really unique about what we do, is we work with artists of all different disciplines and sort of put them together in one space. So when you come into Flashpoint Gallery, if you continue to walk through the gallery, you'll hit a theater. And then if you turn left and keep walking, you'll hit a dance studio. And it's all these people that are mixing together and interacting in that space. And I think there's something really special about that that you don't always see. You know, there's dialogue that's important, and then there's collaboration that's important that's spurred from those interactions. And with Flashpoint Gallery, we do usually between 8 and 10 exhibitions a year. I think we have 11 projects this year, one which will be off-site at MLK Library, and another that will be sort of all over Flashpoint and not just in the gallery. But we try to have different activities and events so that the artists are in dialogue with one another and form a support system for one another. And they're not just sort of working autonomously on their own show, that they become invested in what everyone else in the space is doing as well. So, and then the other thing that Jamie touched on is we do a lot with, we do work with artist housing and community development. So we're making sure that there's space for arts in the city, and we're working with developers. And a lot of that is, there's a lot of education involved in that process, and making sure that they're invested in the arts and that the arts are an important part of new development. So we work really hard on that as well.
Yes. So emerging artists in DC have a lot that's available to them if you just know where and how to seek it out. And CUDC, Flashpoint Gallery, the WPA, and the So Hamiltonian are great resources and great centers of activity for emerging artists. And now I'd like for Paul to tell us about the concept behind the So Hamiltonian Fellowships that he founded, and to describe what exactly is involved in providing a home base for emerging artists in D.C.
Okay. Let me tell you something about my background first, and let me see the motivation why I'm doing what I'm doing. So I guess in some sense I have been an artist for a while, but I came to the art community much later than most of the people on the panel. So the Hamiltonian Artist Project really started really 3 years ago. My day job actually is not in art, it's in physics, and actually I teach physics at George Mason University. Basically 3 years ago, I had some time because sabbatical came along, and there's free time that I can try to do something different. And I want to come back into the art in a way that I want to see the same kind of a support structure that I got as a scientist when I finished my PhD program. So people who are not in the science world, usually when you finish the PhD program, you have a doctoral research period. I think in psychology it's similar. So it's kind of internship. Usually you hook up with a more established, well, a professor, like in the art world with more established artists, and then you will be with that professor for like a year or two doing research. And it's a great time. It's a time that basically you don't need to worry about funding because the professor is supposed to get you funding. And you'll be doing your own research, so you'll be doing, in the art world, you'll be doing art all the time that you want. And also, this is training involved. So it basically would tell you how you become a professor, how you get an academic job. So in some sense, when I had the time, I wanted to bring back my interest in art. I'm a painter myself, and also the experience I had. So in some sense, I want to build up a bridging program for artists who are starting out. So that's how the nucleus of the idea of how the Hamiltonian art started. And as a bridging program, when I thought about what you needed, is really, I can see when I look at the local art scene, there are a lot of support already. But I still don't think it's not enough. And what I kind of see that really needed is, one is venue for them to show their work. The other one is studio space, which I don't have provided for that yet. It's much more difficult to find a studio space. So the part that I actually started 3 years ago really is a venue space that basically ties into a mentorship program. So, and what we basically have at the Hamiltonian Artist right now is basically a fellowship program that consists of providing some money, stipend for the artist, a small amount. But the heart of it is really a mentorship program that tie into the gallery space. So actually, right now, I think there's at least three fellows here. If you are at the end, you can actually talk to them. Ian Davis is one side, Celine is on the other side. I think there may be another one I saw. Oh, yeah. Jessica is over there. So if you want to talk to them, they spend the 3 year that we have. So you can talk about the experience. It's great. So what we provide, we have a so-called focus show each season. So we usually have either two or three at most fellows, and then we usually pair them up with a mentor. So very similar to what Transformer has been doing, but we kind of spend 2 years. So each one of them, each of the fellow will have basically a focus show each year. So they will work with that particular mentor to try and develop the show. And we also run a critique, which also we mentioned that previously. It's very important in the sense that you get feedback. And then there's also studio visits that either the mentor and also the gallery director would do with the fellows. And at the end, you know, we also have hopefully continue a conversation between the mentor and the other fellow within the groups. Mm-hmm. And now the other part of the fellowship program that we also provide is a speaker series. So on that particular part, we provide basically lectures on not necessarily art. So there's also talks on art, but there will be talks on like legal issues, tax issues, or we would have like somebody from the gallery would come in and basically talking about their galleries. We come in and talk to how you're supposed to approach a gallery. And so we just started, finished the second year of our programming, so we're still growing, we're still changing and learning. So hopefully, you know, by 5 years from now or later on, it will be more developed and more integrated with the rest of the programs, I think, in the city. And I think one of this particular program here, I think it's wonderful that we can integrate more of the commercial world as well as the nonprofit world that both, I guess, can benefit from each other.
Absolutely, so. Because we can all move forward together and provide more opportunities for emerging artists. And I think that the topic of how to approach a gallery or gallery representation is something that's foremost on many emerging artists' minds. So I have to admit that I had an ulterior motive in coming to Paul last to make an announcement now that he is going to host at Hamiltonian Gallery the second part of this series of Emerge and have a panel discussion devoted to the topic of gallery representation for emerging artists. And this will happen in September at a date yet to be determined, so stay tuned. If anyone on the panel has further thoughts or ideas, I would like now for all of you to just have at it and come out with them. And then we'll take some questions from the audience.
I actually have a question. I guess being a psychologist, I'm good at asking questions. Zoe's example of reaching out reminded me, I had a student once who was enamored with Shepard Fairey. I think before Shepard Fairey was Shepard Fairey. And I was like, call the guy, you know, reach out to him. And he did and made a contact and got a shipment of stickers. And it was really great for this kid. But he was an outgoing, very extroverted guy. Which Zoe's obviously very introverted and shy. I'm just kidding. No, my point is I think a lot of artists, I'm reminded of a good friend of mine who luckily in Brooklyn has a garage he can paint in, which is the size of this table, but he's lucky to have that space. But for him to reach out to someone would take a lot of effort. I mean, I could introduce him to Mr. Rogers and he would freak out. So I think a lot of these programs sound awesome, like the one that you were involved with at Flashpoint. But I'm wondering, how do people who are less outgoing go about doing those things? I'm just curious what the panel has to say.
Yeah, I think that's really hard. I think it's a really hard question, and I think it's a really hard thing to address for a lot of artists. Because I mean, one of the things that the reality that we have to face up to is that there's something sort of inherently social about the art world, and you can make great art, and there's this stereotype about this. You know, that you'll just be discovered or you'll just be found and you're this reclusive artist just making this fabulous work. Like, you have to work, and it sounds like crass or cheap or something, but you really have to work. You have to know how to promote yourself. And it's also a really sensitive thing of how to promote yourself, too, because, you know, I always make the analogy of courtship. Like, it's kind of like dating someone. You don't want to seem too aggressive or, like, too interested or people, you know, you know, it's this careful balance that you have to deal with. And I think a lot of artists' personalities aren't, you know, and it's a challenge for me personally as someone who works in the arts to go out and be social and sort of create, but you have to create that network for yourself. That dialogue is so important, and that support network is so important. And I think organizations like Cultural Development Corporation and WPA can help, and Hamiltonian can help help create that network and that infrastructure. But I think you have to do it in a way where you can create an infrastructure, and then there's it can still be organic, because I think if it's inorganic, it's ineffective.
I think maybe Christina could talk about the WPA Artist Registry, because that seems to me like a relatively low-impact approach.
Yeah, well, one of the benefits of being a member of WPA is that you get to be a part of our digital online registry called the Art File Online, which is about 3 or 4 years old. It used to be that we had a slide file at our office that curators could make appointment to come flip through, and if you're a member, you could have a file in it. But I mean, that was just got outdated very fast. So this online searchable database is a way for artists who don't have a website to have one instantly. And each page has, you know, up to 12 images per artist. You can have your resume up there. But one thing about it is that it's unlocked. I mean, anyone can go on and look at it, and artists can find each other through it. You can send each other messages through it, so it kind of has like a networking, Facebook-y type aspect to it. But curators and gallerists can also find artists to like round out projects that they're working on. And I'm good friends with a couple of local gallery owners, and like Jamie McCullen from Civilian. She swears by it. She is always surfing it and looking for, you know, people to check out. That's just like a great place to start.
Yeah. It's really interesting the variety of ways that you can build community, because the virtual, you know, so the virtual avenue is viral. You know, there are blogs and there are other sites. There are like the Baker Art Stores. You can see artists that you, if you like those artists, you send them a little message. I mean, it's really interesting, and blogs like Be More Art Blog, and I mean, you can post on there and develop relationships, virtual relationships with people in that way. Another way that I found to build a community or connect with other artists without, you know, going to openings is by going to residency programs, and that's this sort of like built-in way to meet people that are from other areas and people that are like-minded, that are sort of interested in painting or in drawing or in video, and really connect and sort of make connections in that way. Places like the Creative Alliance at the Patterson, it's a live workspace, and those are really great opportunities.
I want to just echo what Zoe's saying, because I think those sorts of communities are really important as well, because there's a really substantial dialogue in those communities, and even with studio visits, you'll create a really substantial dialogue for yourself, and you'll meet, like, artists need that to make work and to have people that they can bounce ideas off of. One of the things that I've heard on more than one occasion artists say is that they have an exhibition, they may have their first solo show, and everyone sort of pats them on the back and says, good job, and you know, there's a sense of community to that, but it needs to be more than that, and just figuring out how to create something more than that, I think, is really important.
I definitely feel like that's like one of the things that is missing. We talk about building community, which is, and I know we have a lot of infrastructure for it, but we certainly need more. You when you say that, Paul, but the one word that is missing, the word that's not been in the room, is sustainable. You know, like, how do we create these spaces? I know one thing, as a performance artist, as an actor, as a writer, as a storyteller, I constantly get the question, what are you doing in D.C.? Why not New York? Why not L.A.? And I imagine that happens in visual arts community just as well. And, I mean, there's one thing about that. We can definitely say that that is a sustainable model that works. But the one thing in D.C. that I always come back with is, is definitely emerging, is definitely across the board. But I think like some places where we need to build this infrastructure is one across media. And that's like one of the exciting things about me being on this panel today is just like when Jamie and Lee and I were just talking about supporting this in a different, I had a different hat on as the manager of Marvin. I wasn't Sheldon, the performer. And I mentioned that this is such a great conversation, and I really hope it could happen across media. And then Jamie said, well, I think you just volunteered yourself to be on the panel. And I think that was like the move in the right direction. We can talk about like the different organizations that exist, but I think the next thing that should happen is how do we create a community that sustains artists? As when I started storytelling 5 years ago, it was one storytelling theater, it was Speakeasy DC, and it was an open mic thing. And if I really wanted to live and sustain as a storyteller, you know, I need a certain amount of exposure that would be able to sustain some type of livelihood. And I can definitely say that I see that, and that is the answer to the question as to why DC. I've been riding this wave because I see it happening. I saw the inception of Fringe Festival to go to where it is now 5 years, one of the fastest growing theater festivals in the city, in the United States. And the one thing about it that's very true is accessibility. And I believe if you afford your artists, your emerging artists, accessibility to new audience, to new people, a different type of critique, that not only raises the level quality of the work that we're doing, because it's really hard for me to get a lot of feedback on like storytelling at another level if I'm not surrounded by or critiqued by other storytellers. And with the internet now, I know there's certain ways that you can do that without physically being in the room. And I know that talent definitely in this city exists on all levels, but that infrastructure to support that talent as that talent grows is what really needs to happen in this city. And I feel like it's happening, and I feel like everybody's moving towards that direction, but I feel more of the conversation should be, how do we do that sustainably?
I have two comments. So one actually is related to what Sheldon is talking about, sustainability. So partially, although I didn't mention at the beginning, the way that I see how I can, at least personally, be able to sustain Humbertonian is the fact that I actually have rebuilt the whole building so that I can actually personally rent out the top. So in case that the bottom had problem, that I can support it. So in some sense, that has some commercial aspect to that that I think a lot of entrepreneurs should actually consider in terms of the city to help out in the art world in developing area, but allot some of the area for the art. Don't just put the whole building into business. You know, if you can somehow at least 20% or 30%, everybody does that, then I think that would be better. Now the other question actually is more like, from my own kind of, for the past 3 years experience that I see in what around DC is, in terms of community, there's two communities. One is, the artist is showing their work, and the other one is in the artist community when they do their work. And I think what is missing in the DC, I think it's Baltimore is much better, is studio space that people can talk to each other. Does Culture Development Corps has any plan in developing studio space instead of just workspace?
Anne might answer that better than me.
Yes, true, sorry.
I can answer it, but our executive director is here.
About 18 months ago, we started shopping for, call it 100,000 square feet, to do what I like to call the coolest office building. Commercial space, and what developers know is office space. They can figure that out. They can't figure studio space out. Anyway, so my hope is to create this very large commercial building that therefore kind of takes Paul's model from, 3,000, 4,000 square feet?
The land area is 3,000.
To take that same model and go huge, so that there's 20 to 25,000 square feet of really cheap studio space. And then it kind of goes up from there. So there might be graphic designers, there might be, lawyers who care about trademark law and that kind of thing on this end, and Christina on that end with the price spectrum. And my inspiration, the best way to sort of think about it is to talk about some best practices. The Tin Factory in Toronto at 401 Richmond is kind of like my dream. They have a great website if you don't get to Toronto often. And That's certainly helpful. CulturalDC.org is where you can find us.
Thanks, Anne. I knew Anne would be able to speak about it much more articulately than I can. And sort of what's distinctive about what we do is that in a lot of ways we're bilingual, so we can speak the language of artists and then also speak the language of the real estate development community. So I think that's really important sort of resource to have.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. I think that developers in Washington are taking note of how art can be a force to better the life and the economy of underserved areas in the city. I think this gallery is living proof of that. The fact that all of you are here today is proof of that. And I think it's very exciting that these initiatives are being set forth. And so take heart, because I know that almost every artist I talk to wants studio space, is looking for studio space, needs more or better studio space. So there are a number of us out here fighting for you to get it, but it is going to take some time. So thank you, Anne, and thank you, Corinne. Are there any other thoughts from the panel before we take some questions?
Just wanted Christina. To piggyback on the topic we were just on, just to embrace kind of like a smaller scale too, or a DIY mentality. Like recently there was a story that Blake Gopnik did about the art spaces in Baltimore, and how inspiring they were to see that artists run spaces. And so I just, at my job, I field a lot of questions from artists looking for spaces. And just recently I found a space that I'm going to end up renting with about three or four other artists, but it's a commercial space that I found on Craigslist. And so I just wanted to mention that if you are having trouble finding a studio, you might want to find a couple other artists and maybe go in together to rent a commercial space. And Craigslist and Redfin. I mean, there's a lot of different resources, but I don't know. Just there's only a few kind of like big studio spaces in DC, and you're always kind of waiting for a spot to open up. But in the meantime, you might be able to do something yourself.
That's a really good tip. I think LoopNet.com also lists commercial spaces if that's the direction that you're heading. I would like to add, before we start taking questions, that another good resource in the city that hasn't been mentioned yet is the DC Commission for the Arts and Humanities, which gives grants to artists and also offers a lot of public art opportunities. So you should definitely check out their offerings for grants that come up cyclically, and get familiar with their programs as well. Okay, I think we have questions, and if I could get Patrick to come take the microphones out.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Klein, and I just wanted to add a couple other resources, not only for emerging artists, but for all of us. A couple things. The Office of Planning initiated a committee to think about urbanism, and one of the things that grew out of it in conjunction with Washington Area Lawyers for the Arts is a resource that's coming up very soon. And it's going to be a resource for real estate. It's going to be not only a PDF document, but Office of Planning is going to translate it into a web-based format as a resource for artists. So look for that in the not-too-distant future. And also, Washington Area Lawyers for the Arts, we've partnered with Paul. We've done some things over at Hamiltonian. He's one of our members. It's a really great value for a little bit of money to be a member of Washington Area Lawyers for the Arts. It's $20 for students and $35 for artists. And we offer workshops, clinics, referrals, pro bono services, so that if you want to have one-on-one about your lease or your particular situation, or you want to come to a workshop on copyrights or trademarks, just go to thewalla.org, and you can find a lot of resources, a lot of good people who are willing to offer their time. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Aziza Gibson Hunter. I'm from Black Artists of DC. We're another resource here in Washington, DC. When you were speaking about sustainability, I have a question about that. What are you doing, or what can we do to develop the collector? Because we talk about all this artist space and everything, but if there's no collector, what is it all about?
I think Pinkline is doing some of that cultivating collectors. I mean, it's a, just one of a few small steps that people are taking, but just having a lot of introductory events that that kind of help connect collectors or new collectors, newbies to artists that are up and coming right now, like with her Salon Contra program. I don't know.
Academy is a great opportunity for people who are just starting to collect to get involved in collecting. It's a great way to support emerging artists, but it's also a way to enter into the market in a relatively painless way. So we've really, over the past 10 years, grown a lot of collectors out of the Academy show, which I'm very happy to say, which is gratifying for the artists as well as the collectors. And also our Go-Go Art projects attracts a lot of new collectors as well.
I'm a mixed media artist and arts writer, and my question is, if you're a self-taught artist as opposed to having a fine arts degree, it seems like there's a bit of a bias or stereotype that your work isn't quite as serious. And I'm wondering as far as if there's any way to confront that, or as far as if you're approaching galleries or things like that, how to deal with that.
I think just embrace it and be proud of it. I mean, I think the art world is filled with people who, you know, their expertise or their background is something else. And I think we live in a world now where you can sort of declare your own expertise and your own legitimacy doing anything you want. I mean, I know that's sort of nebulous advice.
You know, I don't know. I'm really interested in what the concerns, the specific concerns that you have. There's so many spaces that show work by artists of all types. Artists that are, you know, that are recent MFA grads, artists that are self-taught, outsider artists, just et cetera. So I think that you really have to think about your context and the types of venues and target those. The art world is like the art world, and there are a lot of communities in it, and you just have to find your sort of place.
And I know at Flashpoint, like we do an open call for proposals, and I'm thinking about our selection process, and I feel like academic pedigree is really a pretty minor consideration. We hardly ever talk about it. We're just talking about the work.
Jamie, do you find that as a gallerist that there is that you look at people's degrees or whether they have a degree or not?
Well, first we look at the art. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always the most important thing. And if the art is strong, then it really doesn't matter. So I would say don't be discouraged, and maybe part two of this discussion series will be very helpful to you as well about how to approach galleries.
I just wanted to add that I've heard the same complaint from a lot of people in the study that I did, and a lot of it has to do with sort of self-definition as far as my I'm concerned. As a matter of fact, I talked to someone before the talk, and I said, are you an artist? And they were like, well, no, but I paint. And I hear that a lot. People don't want to commit to that term. I mean, myself, I actively still paint, but I wouldn't say I'm an artist. But that what makes you an artist? Is it a degree or a piece of paper? Is it how you conceptualize yourself? And I think a lot of that is sort of personal roadblocks, maybe not in your case, but some people I've talked to, where they say, well, I don't have an MFA, so I'm not even going to, you know, send my work to that jury show because they're not going to consider me because I don't have an MFA. So then they're not in the show, and that's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And they're like, well, I didn't get in the show because I don't have an MFA. Well, no, because you didn't really try. You know what I mean? So I think a lot of it is sort of our own self-definition of what we are and what we consider ourselves to be. So.
Hello. Self-taught artist here and persistent at it. And my comment was going to be that regardless of how antisocial you are, how poor a self-marketer you are, or how much you have to work on the side to do it, the most important thing about being an artist and living as an artist is to keep making work. And believe me, even if you're not snatched up as soon as you're graduated by a gallery, it's actually probably an advantage not to merge into the market that early, because you really have a chance to become an individual voice if you're not already a fierce one at school. So the main thing then is to persist, as been what's been said, and as the good doctor says, you know, you define yourself, so do it.
Hello, my name is Jonah Barham, and I'm a student of music composition. And I talk about a lot of these infrastructure issues with friends of mine in the visual arts, and I also do some printmaking too. My question is, how can the artistic community get political clout and leverage that to solve these infrastructure problems like, you know, no cheap studio spaces?
I think the first thing that we should do as an artistic community is be able to articulate exactly what it is we want. I know one of the amazing opportunities that I'm seeing happening in D.C. right now with all these closing schools, wouldn't it be an amazing thing if one of those schools would just transform into this, like, multimedia creative art space? Each physical wing becomes visual arts, performance arts, music. But, you know, we have to be able to articulate that, and I know Jamie, you mentioned the D.C. Arts and Humanities Commissions. I love what they do. The individual grants, you know, the $2,000, the $5,000, those are very important things, and they mean a lot to the individual artists, but to the community as a whole, if there was some way to reroute that money to fund and subsidize something like that, I think the impact would be a lot greater. You know, there's no mistaking that the eyes of the world is on Washington, D.C. right now for a number of reasons. And I think we have the attention. And if we could somehow pull that, again, that big I word, the infrastructure up, but I think it has to be done politically. Now, how do we do that? I think this is a great start where we start with conversations like this across media, and maybe, you know, afterwards when we're eating beef patties and sucking on ribs, we could have a further conversation and find people, you know, who might be able to help each other or like are some way related to someone who could actually make something like that happen.
Sheldon made excellent points. I think it's going to take both. It's going to take private investment, and it's going to take cooperation with the D.C. government, maybe through tax abatements and other certain considerations, but that would certainly be welcome for developers or small business people who are supporting the arts. And I think that that the time has come. Like Sheldon said, all the eyes of the country and the world are on D.C. right now, and this is our moment, so we're trying to make the most of it, and we have a better chance if we do it together.
Thank you. I'm a student for the University of Barcelona, and talking about working for the community, as the artist just mentioned now, is that the community itself should see how artists collaborate with each other and with the rest of the curators and all the our universe, would say, to the community, so the rest will see, because meetings like this are very useful, but also we should be able to be seen by the rest of the community, of people who say, oh, I don't go to galleries or museums because I don't have a clue about art. I'm sorry, I cannot join you, because then I will feel inadequate. I wouldn't say what to, wouldn't know what to say or which comments. So we should also, in a way, educate our community, the place where we are living right now, which is the city or Barcelona or New York or wherever. I think we have the responsibility to communicate in an understandable way to the rest, to the observers. We can also be co-participants with us into the art field. Thank you.
And it's actually one of the missions of the WPA is not only to help local artists, but also to present art in new and exciting ways. We always have traditional exhibitions throughout the year, but then we try to do programs in all the different wards that are a little bit more just fun and kind of unexpected. We had a parade over by the National Stadium, and then next weekend, in collaboration with Connor, we're going to have a synchronized swimming competition and also show some swimming-related art videos at the Capitol Skyline Pool. But which, although it seems like it's a joke, is actually serious. I mean, it's going to be performance artists doing performances, but the people that happen to be at that pool that day will be treated to this experience they didn't already plan on coming. So, but yeah, we need more things like that. I mean, I think a lot of the nonprofit organizations and galleries try to do a little bit of that, and that helps.
Hi, my name is Amber Robles-Gordon. I have a question about the only aspect of the art world that I don't see here, and that's about the written part of it. What about the critiques? What about the people that are writing? What about the work? It's a really critical part, and DC is lacking in that area.
I think one of the ways that you start to see more of that is that artists have to write themselves. I mean, a really great example of that is Kara Ober, who started the Be More Art blog, and she also writes for other publications. And it's interesting because it's very rare to meet an artist that writes extremely well, that uses a certain particular way of writing or a particular style of writing or a language. And so if you are an artist like that, please contribute. Those are the things, that's really what we need. And that's taking something back. But could I just mention one more model? And I like what you're talking about. It's a very political thing to do. It's something that Area 405 did. A group of 6 or 7 artists got together and purchased a building, an old blind factory, on the north of the train station in a section of town that is completely run down. That was an extremely political move, and they have a lot of power in that neighborhood. And that's something else that artists could do, is get together and purchase something.
For a while was just working part-time and doing my art practice on the side, and I found that like Blue Cross individual coverage, if you get like the most basic HMO, was like manageable. And eventually, after I worked at the same place for a long enough time, I asked if instead of a raise, if they would cover my health insurance, and can kind of figure. But I think there are 2 or 3 companies in DC that offer pretty affordable rates.
When I graduated from college, I didn't have health insurance, and I just got what's called a catastrophic policy. And if you just Google that.
Howdy, Terry Ward here. This is D.C., not West Gophertown, Delaware. And I could understand if arts organizations in, let's say, West Gophertown, Delaware, only helped people of West Gophertown because the resources are so small, and they don't want to send money out or support out of the area. D.C. is different. D.C. is like New York or Chicago in that it is a magnet city, and there are a lot of creative producers who can't necessarily afford to live in the city, but would sure like to get a toehold within the city. I know a bunch of people who are way out in the countryside. Grants and support and subsidized studio space are great for people who can afford to live in the city, and that, you know, I don't condemn that. It's great. But I'm wondering, are any of the organizations represented, this is as much for podcast use, people will look, you know, as for me, are any of the entities open to giving boosts to artists who live way the heck out there in the countryside but still consider themselves part of the extended D.C. area?
Well, I can tell you that the Flashpoint Gallery accepts proposals internationally. There's no geographic limit.
The WPA, we're D.C., Maryland, Virginia, but that extends, I mean, further out too. We have some international members and people from New York. It's anyone who just wants to be a part of the D.C. metropolitan community, but and then we have a lot of members from Baltimore and Richmond, and then also out in the sticks. And,
I think that's true for most of the non-governmental organizations. Same for Hamiltonian. So our applicant came from national, but since we require them to participate, so they have to be able to get here. So in some sense, actually, we do have a lot of fellow from Baltimore. So they drive down, and I think that's possible. And if there are more leap workspace possible, that I guess then obviously they can utilize them and can be here. But I think for DC, this, or state government, this, by that require politics, I think, to have them to really support outside the district kind of artists. So that's, I don't know how to deal with that.
Well, thank you very much.